The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're spending the hour learning about the fascinating history of lighter-than-air flight. Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. I'm joined by Richard Holmes, editor of the Harper Perennial series Classic Biographies, and the author of so many books and papers on science and history that I cannot begin to list them all. I will mention his group biography of scientists and poets, The Age of Wonder, that was chosen as Time Magazine's number one nonfiction title for 2009. He's also written several drama documentaries for BBC Radio, including The Frankenstein Experiment, A Cloud in a Paper Bag, about 18th century balloon mania, and Anesthesia, about the gas experiments of Humphrey Davy. He's here to talk about his new book, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
It's a pleasure to be flying with you.
Lovely. Now, how far back does the history of hot air ballooning go? Your book covers mainly 19th century balloon flight, but the process was developed far earlier than that, correct?
Yes. The classic dates are 1783, when the first Montgolfiers, which were hot air balloons, were flown in France. We can talk about that. And then earlier than that, it kind of, the history becomes more like mythology. There are various flying clerics in the medieval period, and we even go back to South America. They're thought to be hot smoke balloons being flown out of Peru and possibly even across the Pacific, and going even further back to ancient Chinese civilizations, where there is the great Chinese scholar Joseph Needham referred to hot air balloons which are used to carry messages or even rather charmingly love letters. But these are all sort of halfway between myth and legend, very difficult to establish it. So the real scientific flying begins at the end of the 18th century, and 1783 is the key date.
Well, I was reading something a while back about those images that appear to be UFOs pictured in ancient art, mostly religious art, actually. If you Google UFOs in old paintings, you can find a ton of examples. But I was wondering, could those UFOs have been hot air balloons? Like, would there have been working, if rudimentary, balloons in France in 1338, for example?
Well, it's possible, but again, these may also have been saints who were flying up to heaven. They may have been strange forms of cloud. We just don't know. It's very difficult to get documentary evidence. I'll give you a kind of example. If we went even earlier, I mentioned Peru and the strange carvings which are on the Nazca Plateau in southern Peru. Now, these are, your listeners will probably have seen images of this. They're enormous images of birds and animals carved on the plateau, on the rock, which are several, each image is several miles long. And the theory is that it would be impossible to carve these unless you had some commanding position above the plateau. So the idea was that maybe the shamans, the priests, and so on, flew in smoke balloons above the plateau. And indeed, there were a series of modern experiments made at the end of the 20th century to see if such balloons could be flown. And the conclusion was they could, but there was no documentary evidence. And again, you know, there's a very interesting specialist literature saying, oh, well, maybe these were the gods, these were UFOs coming down to direct the carvings and so on. And we then go off into, you know, a kind of crazy, grassy knoll section.
Yeah, we tend not to go in that direction. But I'm wondering, so if there were balloons that early on, what might they have been used for?
Very interesting. What on earth could they be used for? The idea that man wanted to fly in some shape or form is a sort of very, it goes right back, obviously, to the Greek Icarus legends, which, of course, those are winged. The idea of flying, you remember Icarus flies too close to the sun, and the wax seals on his wings melt and he falls to earth. So that's a very early part of the myth. It appears in Ovid's Metamorphoses legends. So the principle of trying to fly seems to be there. It's absolutely old age, innate thing. And the French poet, this is modern 19th century poet, Victor Hugo, came up with a very neat theory about this. He said when man looks up at the sky, he sees two things. He sees clouds and he sees birds. And those were the two great lines of development. Could man fly under a cloud, i.e. in a balloon, or could he have wings like a bird, and that would produce the aeroplane? And that's the great sort of division in this desire to take to the skies. But it seems to be there very deep in very early literature and legend.
Well, even moving into the 19th century, there's still that sense of wanting to fly, but not knowing, you know, what the practical applications of flying might be.
That's right. And what we get, it all starts really in the chemist laboratories in England and in France, where they're beginning to work on what they call artificial airs, which we would call gases. And a number of gases are isolated in the end of the 18th century, including, for instance, hydrogen and oxygen and nitrous oxide and so on. And an English scientist called Black, Joseph Black, isolated hydrogen, and he saw that it was one of its features was that it was lighter than air, this wonderful sort of counterintuitive thing that you can weigh natural air. It has a weight, and you can produce an artificial air, a gas, which is 14 times lighter than air. Wonderful sort of paradoxical idea. So these ideas of lighter than air gases were already around in the laboratories of France and England. But the application came in a very interesting form, actually. Again, in a sort of rather modern way, the two brothers, the brothers Montgolfier, who lived down in the Ardennes region of France, and they were commercial paper manufacturers. They were very interested in the latest technology, and they read about these experiments with hydrogen gas. And they wondered if maybe they could inflate a paper bag with hydrogen, which would be a wonderful form of advertising for their commercial company producing paper bags in various forms of wrapping and so on. And the specific sort of a legend that is attached to the Montgolfier brothers is that they watched the underwear of one of their wives drying on a clothes horse in front of the fire, and the hot air filled it and made it balloon and rise. And immediately they connected this with the idea of hydrogen. And so in 1783, they began to make experiments with literally paper bags held over hot air. They were confused whether hydrogen was hot air or something special. They simply used burning straw. And it's quite clear from the early notes that they thought it was the smoke produced by the burning straw. That's what made the balloons rise. In fact, of course, it's the hot air which makes the molecules move faster, and therefore they become lighter from the ambient air around it. And those initial balloons were flown down outside Paris in the summer of 1783, and it was very clear that a reasonably large balloon, something with a paper bag of about 10 foot or 20 foot diameter, had enormous lifting power. And it took several men to hold it down over the fire. And when it flew out of sight and created a complete sensation. And crowds would come to watch this. And that's the second thing about balloons. Not only is the idea of flight enchanting to people, but it is amazingly attractive. And this has gone right through ballooning history. Balloons produce crowds. Even to this day, I can tell you, if you land in a hot air balloon, anywhere in England or America, you have a crowd around you almost immediately. And of course, if you're inflating and taking off, the same is true. So the Montgolfier brothers realized they had a very intriguing, not just a scientific instrument, but a commercial instrument which would attract people. They brought it to Paris. The king, the French king, got interested. The Académie des Sciences got interested. They realized the Montgolfiers were using hot air. But their scientists started working, particularly Lavoisier, on the use of hydrogen. And in the autumn of 1783, there were a series of flights. The first man carrying Montgolfier, and almost immediately afterwards, in December 1783, the first genuine hydrogen balloon piloted by a wonderful member of the French Academy, Dr. Alexandre Schall. And he left the most brilliant account of this first flight. And the one thing I'll pick out for it, that he went, he climbed to 10,000 feet and he flew, that this first flight was in the late afternoon. He landed, first of all, with a companion who he asked to get out of the basket, thereby lightening the balloon. The sun had set. They'd watched the sun setting. When the companion got out of the balloon, of course, it lightened, this hydrogen balloon, and it immediately rose to 10,000 foot. And Charles said, I'm the first person who's seen the sun set twice in the same day. Wonderful lyrical account of it. Incidentally, I think he was also terrified. He never flew again. He delivered this wonderful account to the Académie des Sciences, but that was it. And from then on, and we can talk about this, a kind of mania of flying balloons crossed all over Europe and into England and quite soon into America.
Well, that's the interesting thing. The sort of pre-1820, the pioneering stage of ballooning, that really did revolve around entertainment.
Yes, it with two elements to theory. I think when I looked at this, looked at the documentation and looked at the reports that the Académie des Sciences were receiving in Paris, but also the Royal Society in London. Sir Joseph Banks was then the president, and I'd looked at his letters and papers and the way they discussed the phenomena of balloons. And there were kind of two elements to this. Yes, there was the crowd pulling, the entertainment element. There's no doubt about that. And the Paris balloons produced the biggest crowds in the areas like the Luxembourg Gardens and the Tuileries that ever formed before the French Revolution. Enormous crowds. In fact, the observers were rather worried about this. They were frightened about the number of people who were drawn together. So that was its entertainment factor. But particularly in London, the Royal Society, they considered, was it a navigation instrument? Was it an instrument of commercial transport? And there are a lot of papers about this. And indeed, one of Joseph Banks' earliest letters says this is going to produce a revolution in transportation more profound than anything since the ship, right? So the idea that the transport in the air had been conquered by balloons. There was, and it became very quickly clear, there was one problem with this second idea of transportation, that to be effective, a balloon has to rise at A and go to B, a place you want to go to, a target beforehand, all right, a destination. And the one thing that balloon can't do, they can go to rise at A, but they cannot go to B. They'll go to X, and you don't know where that is. And the history of the first 20 years, or even 30 years of ballooning, both in England and in France and in Germany, and indeed in America in the 1790s, was attempts to build any kind of navigational equipment attached to the basket. So you get quite fantastic, and there are wonderful pictures of all these, huge silken wings flapping that you flap from the basket, kind of wooden propellers that you turn, oars, aerial oars. Can you imagine this? You sit in the basket and you attempt to row your balloon along. And then even more one that you would somehow harness birds, swans were particularly popular. You'd harness swans to your balloon basket and direct them, and they would take you from A to B. So the first 20 or 30 years of ballooning in Europe was spent trying to find some scientific way of directing the balloon as an instrument of transport. And it gradually became clear that this is the one thing that a balloon could not do. So the horizontal journey became something quite different. Later, and we'll talk about this in a minute, in the 19th century, it is the vertical journey that becomes interesting, that it gradually is realized that the balloon is an amazing instrument for going up and discovering what is happening, not necessarily 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 feet above, what happens up there. And this becomes a whole history of exploration there, the vertical exploration of the balloon. So that division exists, and it still exists today. The hot air balloon is one of the great universal sports practiced all around the world. And also balloons are still used, of course, weather balloons and so on, high atmospheric balloons. and indeed even as forms of drones and so on. So there's two questions, the horizontal and the vertical.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm here with Richard Holmes, author of Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. And we'll be back with more right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. We're exploring the history of 19th century ballooning with Richard Holmes, author of Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. So we're mainly talking about what happened in Europe. Now, when did the Americans get into the game?
Well, in fact, it was a French poet, Jean-Pierre Blanchard, who was one of the most brilliant balloonists in Europe. He was the first person who flew the Channel. In fact, starting in England, the English Channel, that is, and flying southwards across, it's about a 25-mile gap, to the northern coast of France. Very interesting, this is always signed up as a great British triumph, but in fact there were two pilots, Jean-Pierre Blanchard, who was French, and his co-pilot was Dr. John Jeffries, who was actually an American, also a fellow of the Royal Society. So those two had this great international success in January 1785 of flying across the Channel. And then Blanchard became internationally famous, and he took his balloons across to America. And I think the crucial date was 1794. He was in Philadelphia, and he flew the first balloon from the center of the city of Philadelphia. Rather interesting, he because of the great crowds, the worthies of the city of Philadelphia, of course, Franklin City and so on, were anxious that the crowds would get out of hand. So he flew from the inside the local prison, which I think it's called the Chestnut Street Prison, or the Walnut Street Prison, I forget exactly now, but it is famous, it has a plaque there, in order so that they would make a clean liftoff. And they flew across the Delaware River, and he carried a lovely thing, a passport from Washington, which said that wherever he landed, he should be received as a citizen of the universe, of the world, and looked after. Wonderful idea, and that passport note still exists. So that was the beginnings. Jean-Pierre Blanchard, he goes back to France. He falls in love with a girl from La Rochelle called Sophie, who he marries, much younger than him. And she becomes, you know, she is the great attraction in his ballooning. She's very elegant in the basket. Blanchard grows old and dies, and Sophie Blanchard turns out to be the most brilliant woman balloonist and has a staggering career. Really, she flew in these tiny little baskets that looked like champagne buckets. She stayed up all night in a balloon. She was adopted by Napoleon as the official balloonist of the empire. She did great performance celebration balloons across above Paris, above Rome, above Milan. A dazzling young woman and incredibly brave, and crazily brave, because after the restoration of the Bourbon monarchy in 1815-16, she immediately became the official balloonist of the restored monarchy. No political problems there. But she developed, can you imagine this, a firework display. So she would go up in a balloon above the Luxembourg Gardens or the Tivoli Gardens, and she would set off more and more complicated sets of fireworks, the Roman candles, and all kinds of rockets and silver showers and so on. And she was doing this on long rods suspended from the basket with a hydrogen balloon above her, which of course is lethally inflammable. She successfully did this between 1815 and 1819, and then one summer evening by the Tivoli Gardens, that balloon caught fire. And again, amazing, her last thing, she managed to bring the balloon down while it was on fire. but she brought it down on a rooftop. And it was actually not falling from the balloon, it was falling from the roof into the street below that killed her. And she's got a monument in Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, and wonderful accounts of that. So that was Sophie Blanchard, the young second wife of Jean-Pierre Blanchard. The great period of early free ballooning in America is a little bit later, actually. It's in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And that has a very particular and interesting and dramatic history, which we can talk about.
Well, that's what I was wondering. American ballooning seemed to have a very different flavor than the European form.
Yes. What happens to American balloonists? First of all, they're ballooning in a very big land, the 3,500 width of America. And the balloon is very quickly seen as an instrument that will explore simply the size of the territory. And it will possibly, again, the idea that it might be some form of transport because the country is so big. So the American balloonists in the 40s and 50s are launching further and further west. So, for example, Cincinnati becomes one of the great bases for balloon launch. And they're flying always in the prevailing wind, which actually happens to always fly eastwards. And there are various ideas of producing companies that will carry airmail or various transport systems over these vast distances. And there are three American balloonists absolutely heroic, crazy and heroic in my mind. John Wise, the first one, who flew amazing distances from Cincinnati across the Great Lakes up to the Canadian border. He flies the earliest flight across to Niagara Falls, a very interesting account of that. And a wonderful account of the kind of largeness of America as seen from a balloon, flights that go on days and nights. That flight to upper state New York was almost 1,000 miles, which is had broke all kinds of records. And Wise wrote brilliantly about it. I'll give you a couple of wonderful descriptions of the big rivers, the Mississippi and so on, and then flying at night, things that you might not think of, that, of course, you can hear a great deal. You can smell what is below. You can smell a township, or you can smell an agricultural field in the dark. And he, one of his great inventions for night flying was what he called dog navigation. He would call down through the dark and to see if he could get an answering bark. All right? You must imagine you're out on the prairies in the dark. And John Wise said, if you got one dog replied, you knew you were flying over country of small, isolated farmsteads. All right? If you got a wonderful chorus of dogs who replied to your shout through the dark, then you knew you were flying over a township, and you could tell by the number of dogs how big it was.
That's brilliant.
And if you got no bark in return, you knew you were over the empty prairie. So full of wonderful accounts like that. And the two other great balloon pilots, American balloon pilots, was John Lamontagne, wonderful name, who was a younger man, I think more reckless, we'll come back to him, and probably the greatest of all these mid-century pilots was Thaddeus S. Lowe, a marvelous balloonist who in the end made his name flying observation balloons during the American Civil War, and we can talk about that.
Which is interesting because his perspective was the most scientific, was it not?
That's right. He trained as a chemist, and in fact he gave wonderful lectures, indeed, on the gases, hydrogen and so on. He met his young wife, who was a French, very pretty French girl, who was in the front row of one of his lectures up in New York, and she joined him. A very successful marriage, incidentally. So his background was yeah, scientific, chemical. He was very interested in the techniques of ballooning, what you could do with rip panels to make ballooning safer. He adopted the idea of the guide rope, which the English had invented, which is a big manila rope which hangs below the basket and drags along the ground, and it adjusts the height of a balloon, because if you go down, if you go lower, then more of the rope is lying on the ground, and therefore less of the weight is in the basket. So it's like a self-adjusting mechanism. Lowe was very good with various experiments like that.
Now, would that have only have been possible because of sort of the wide open spaces of America at the time?
Yes, a very good point. When this was used in Europe, you know, these big ropes pulling across wheat fields, and famously sort of lifting tiles on small churches and damaging fences. The balloonist very quickly became very unpopular from that point of view, particularly in England. All right, in France, it's just bigger, more coveted. It was better, and indeed, it's one of the sort of legends of 19th century ballooning, is that if you go over someone, fly over a chateau, the Duke will come out and shout up and say, "Come down for dinner, come down for dinner," and that wonderful stories associated with that. But in America, this was different. It was more businesslike. You could use things like rip panels and these trail ropes, guide ropes. But where I'm getting to with Thaddeus Lowe is that he was flying balloons, doing long-distance flights out of Cincinnati. He had his great overall dream was he wanted to fly from the eastern seaboard right across the Atlantic to Europe or to England. This was his life dream. An achievement which was not actually made until the 20th century. Although, a kind of footnote that I love having in my book, it was made in fiction, all right? There was a balloon crossing of the Atlantic in 1844, and it was the other way. It was from Ireland to Newfoundland, and it had three balloonists in the basket, and they kept a wonderful diary, which was published in the New York Sun. Brilliant account of this three-day crossing and how the navigation equipment they used. Absolutely convincing. And it was all written by none other than Edgar Allan Poe. And it was a complete hoax. And that was the first brilliant crossing, 1844. And it's something I pursue in the book because balloon flight does seem to encourage a whole area of fiction. Jules Verne wrote one of his first great science novel, 5 weeks in a Balloon, about three Englishmen crossing right across Africa, entirely fiction. So the history sits very brilliantly alongside the fiction. Back to Thaddeus Lowe. He was flying always east, always hoping to cross the Atlantic, but his plans were interrupted by the outbreak or declaration of the American Civil War. And he decided, being a patriot on the Union side, that he would present his services to the new young President Lincoln in Washington. And he takes one of his balloons by train to Washington just at the outbreak of the war, 62. And he inflates it on the Mall, right in front of the White House. And he has it tied down, so it's on a tether rope, about 1,000 feet, and he has this brilliant idea to bring two technologies together. He takes up in the balloon a telegraph key and a wire going down, following the tether, and he gets this telegraph wire linked directly to the White House, and he's able to send a telegraph message in Morse code describing the view from 1,000 feet above the Mall in Washington, and it goes directly to Lincoln's desk. And thereby, Lowe manages to form, with the president's help, the first balloon company, the American Balloon Company, that is under the, I think it's under the command of the cavalry section of the Union Army of the Potomac. And for the next 2 years, he flies a series of very dangerous observation expeditions above various battlefields. The young John LaMontagne is doing the same thing in the peninsula. And Lowe's most famous achievement, I think, is probably flying an observation balloon above in the Seven Days Battle outside Richmond, the Confederate capital at that time. And there's a great battle outside Richmond, and he helps by observing the movements of troops, telegraphing messages down. In fact, the Union lose that battle, the 7 days battle, and Low's great claim is that he, by telegraphing intelligence, he is able to save the Union army from being cut off, and they are successfully able to retreat from Richmond. And there are all kinds of stories attached to that. One of the most interesting I might mention is the famous silk dress balloon. This is a balloon that was thought to be entirely legendary, mounted by the rebels, by the Confederates, who were much poorer in finances and materials, and in theory were not able to afford a balloon. The silk was very expensive, very difficult to get, that gas was a problem, and so on. And there was this legend of the silk dress balloon, which was said to have been assembled from all the silk ballroom dresses of the Southern belles. The girls had all volunteered their dresses so that the Confederacy could have its own balloon, and they were sewn together, and this balloon was flown out of Richmond as a countermeasure to also observe what was happening on the ground. Various American researchers have done work on this, and it turns out that there really was a silk dress balloon. And it's a fabulous story, actually. And it did fly during the defense of Richmond. And eventually it was captured when it was tethered to a boat on the Potomac, which was towing it down one morning to make observations of the retreating Union army. And the boat ran on a sandbank, and it was captured, and the balloon was captured inside it. And then, of course, it was torn up in pieces, and these little fragments of the silk dress balloon became immensely precious. People on both sides, armies, had them. And I discovered in Low's archive, which finished up in the Library of Congress in Washington, one of the most moving parts of my research. I was going through his original notes and letters, and he wrote a memoir about his time in the Civil War. And out of one of the letters, as I opened it, fell this slip of rather stiff silk about the size of a playing card. And it was a piece of the original Richmond silk dress balloon, and Low absolutely treasured it. And it was something very touching about that. Here was this thing that had meant to be a legend, but actually it was true. And it's one of the sort of fascinations, again, of balloon history, that something that appeared to be fiction then turns out to be true, whereas other things which appear to be true turn out to be fiction. Very interesting for a researcher.
And that actually wasn't the last time that it's difficult to tell fiction from fact. You're listening to Science for the People, and I'll be back with more of Richard Holmes, author of Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air, after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're discussing invading organisms, large and small. We'll talk to Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, to learn why and how researchers are creating new strains of flu virus. We're joined by marine invertebrate researcher Dr. Benjamin Miner to talk about the wasting disease killing starfish on the west coast of North America. And we'll talk to physicist Ross Lockwood about the High Seas Project, exploring the psychological conditions facing a human crew on a mission to Mars. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is prolific writer Richard Holmes, editor of the Harper Perennial series Classic Biographies, and the author of a book about 19th century balloon flight, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Now, your book is full of stories, fascinating, all of them. But the story of how the balloons were used in France, specifically in Paris during the Prussian blockade, that has become one of my favorite stories, balloon-related or not. So maybe just give us some background there. What was happening in France politically?
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the most fantastic episodes in ballooning. We are, take you back, it's 1870. The French, under the foolish Emperor Napoleon III have attempted to invade the young Prussian state, and Prussia is at that moment governed by Bismarck, and it has a brilliant Prussian general, von Moltke, and of course they beat the French at the Battle of Sedan. Napoleon III is captured and sent into exile, and the Prussian army, divided in two or three sections, marches westwards, and with amazing efficiency, they surround Paris in a space of about 3 weeks. We're in September 1870. And they completely close off the city of over 2 million people. Difficult to imagine how you could do that now. You have to remember that there were telegraph lines and there were railroads, but there was obviously no radio, no mobile phones, no other forms of communication. And the Prussians were able to cut the telegraph lines. They blew up all the bridges. They blew up the railroads, the train lines, and they completely isolated the city. And the diplomatic and military plan was simply to starve the population into submission. And they reckoned they could do that in a matter of months. And in Paris, the imperial government had dissolved. There was a provisional government. And there was desperation about how they would feed the population. They slaughtered every animal in the city, not a single horse for drawing cabs existed. They killed all the animals in the Jardin des Plantes, the zoo. They chopped down all the trees in the Bois de Boulogne for firewood. I'm giving you these details because you have to imagine how despairing and how the whole problem of civilian morale in the city was desperate. And of course they were cut off. There was no messages of getting the outside world. The Times of London had a correspondent, but he was with the Prussian army. There were no messages getting through the lines at all. So what happens in September 1870, this small group of French balloonists led by this amazing man called Félix Nadar, who was the man who first took a photograph from a balloon earlier in 1858, who was a genius at publicity. And he decided, talking to his fellow balloonists, there was one way that was still open, that was the air. And the air had always belonged to France. It was the Montgolfiers who established ballooning, and this was the way they would attempt to break the Prussian siege. So what happened in over a period of 3 or 4 months, they began to mass produce hydrogen balloons. They built them in the big terminal, railway terminals, which of course were not being used, which had sufficiently high roofs that you could hang the silk from the balloons, sew them, seal them, construct the baskets. And in this short period, they sent off no less than 67 balloons from Paris. And the great thing about these balloons, they weren't taking people out so much, although they did take some scientists and politicians. What they were taking out was mail, letters, so that the civilian population could communicate with their families and also, of course, with the rest of diplomatic Europe. And they carried, in the end, of this period of 3 or 4 months, over 2 million letters went out. And they devised a form, a kind of lightweight airmail, so the airwell bags could be carried out. They'd have one pilot in every balloon. And here, the great limitation of the balloon, do you remember we talked about it can leave A, but it can never get to
right.
B. It doesn't matter. As long as you can fly over the Prussian lines, which might be 30 or 40 miles deep, or 60 or 70 kilometers deep, in any direction, then you're beyond the where you come down, you're back within a civilian population in France or in Belgium, and the letters are then transferred to the railway system, and they can be sent out all over France. And they designed a way of getting the replies back. Very interesting. Nadar helped invent a kind of microfilm so that letters could be photographed on very fine film, sent back by a carrier pigeon into Paris. So the balloons carried mail and carrier pigeons. And that way they established in these desperate months an extraordinary mail system, which had an immense impact on the morale of the civilian population. A number of famous French writers notably Victor Hugo, who came back for the siege, wrote about the balloons. They sent messages in balloons. Indeed, there was a balloon. All the balloons were named deliberately to provoke the Prussians. And there was a Victor Hugo balloon. And he suggested that they would throw out pamphlets addressed to the Prussian army saying, really, time you went home. He wrote these wonderful universal letters. Nadar, who sent the first balloon off, had a clutch of his own business cards, and they simply signed with compliments to von Bismarck, and they threw them out. So there was this amazing element of sort of French inventiveness and sort of wit attached to these balloons, but also incredible courage. And the flight of every one of these 67 balloons is now known. Two or three were lost over the Atlantic. They flew westwards. And two or three were lost that flew too far eastwards and actually landed in Germany, where we think their pilots were probably shot. But one amazing example is a balloon that went sort of northeast, flew all through the night in a storm. When it landed with three mailbags, it was on a snow-covered mountainside in Norway. And yet they managed to get the mailbags back to Kristiansand, the kind of modern Oslo, and they actually delivered the mail by railway all across Europe. And I've seen some of these original letters, balloon marked Ballon Monté, which means carried by a man-carrying balloon. And they've addressed, I've had one in my hands which is addressed to someone in Sydney, Australia, and another to an address in San Francisco. So it was the most extraordinary technical achievement. And in a way, in the book, I say that in a way, this is a kind of apotheosis. Ballooning found out its real role in that. And it's always been loved in France ever since then. Various little details like they organized, the Figaro organized the first airmail newspaper, which was sent out in the baskets from these balloons with all the news of what was happening in Paris, and then it was copied and sent all over France and England. The first balloon sent out by Nadar, not only with his business card, it carried a letter, who to? The London Times, saying, we're in a bad way here in Paris, understand what's happening to us, try and support us, and keep an eye on the Prussians so they don't behave too badly. I mean, just, you know, the London Times published that in French.
This is the thing. Victor Hugo could have written this. But this actually happened.
This actually happened. And again, I've seen, there is the letter in the archives of the London Times signed by Nadar. And Hugo himself wrote a number of poems about the balloons and also about the pigeons flying back. They become wonderful symbols of free France, the balloon going out and then the message, carrier pigeon, going out to the west and then coming back into Paris. So it becomes a great symbol, and it's something that the Prussians, although of course they did successfully get Paris to submit, they never really found a way of dealing with this balloon publicity. They tried all kinds of things. They employed hawks. They tried to use guns to shoot. They never managed to shoot the balloons down. So it was a kind of triumph, a wonderfully eccentric, brilliant, fantastic, witty triumph for the French balloonists. And it makes a great story. And there are a lot of other details about the way they painted posters and wonderful pictures about the balloons. And later they made a wonderful balloon monument in Paris. Incidentally, a very neat little historical footnote. When the Germans, at least the Nazi army, marched into Paris again in 1940, almost the first thing they did was blow up the balloon monument from 1870, which is a kind of triumph for the balloonists in their own way. Anyway, so that's one of the stories. And I think, Desiree, the point about this is that ballooning seems a quite eccentric history, but actually, when you begin to follow it through, not only are the human stories fantastic, really, and really fascinating, but also they begin to throw a kind of light on history in general. And it seems to me that the whole history of warfare is reflected in the American Civil War, the first accounts of what a Civil War battle is like are seen from the air, from the observation balloons, and how really terrible it is, the effect of modern automatic or semi-automatic weapons and so on, what that's like, and grenades and so on. And in the same way, in Europe, those balloons which were flying out of Paris and London and so on, gave the first accounts of what the great industrial cities were like. Wonderful accounts of flying over iron foundries and so on in the dark and hearing the workers down below and smelling it all and seeing it all. And the ballooning history throws a light on history, human history in general, in a quite unexpected way.
Okay, so balloons were used in the military and for entertainment and for publicity. But the one thing we haven't really spoken about at any length, and it is the theme of our show, is using balloons for science. And Lo was able to sort of dabble in that a bit, but I'd really like to talk about James Glacier.
Yes. So we talked about horizontal journeys, and now we're talking about vertical journeys going up. All right. Now, the history of this, of scientific high-altitude flying, begins, again, in France, really. A wonderful chemist of in the 1820s called Gay-Lussac, who's a contemporary of people like Humphrey Davy in England and so on, and a bit younger than Joseph Henry in America and Washington. Gay-Lussac was, as a chemist, very interested in what happened above 10,000 feet and did a series of balloon ascents in 1804, 1805 from Paris. But were they also interested in what happened to magnetic fields, what happened to air pressure and so on, but without much effect. So later in the century, in the 1860s, the Royal Society in England and also the British Association for the Advancement of Science suddenly begin to think of setting up a series of expeditions vertically to find out what happens up there. And again, it's interesting writing about this because you have to be able to imagine what people didn't know. All right. So you start with, they didn't know, for instance, what the structure of clouds were. Was electricity carried in clouds? Would you be electrocuted if you flew into high cloud? They didn't know much about meteorological patterns, but they were getting very interested in that. Barometric pressures, what happened when you went up? The pressure drops, and in fact, that's the way an altimeter works. But what happens when you go up very far? What happens to the air? What happens to the temperature? So there's a whole series of unknowns, and it was decided to mount a series of expeditions in 1860 vertically, flying from Wolverhampton, which is the most central part of England, furthest from any coast. And you have a man who was secretary at that moment and became president of the Royal Meteorological Society in England, a rather fascinating man called James Glacier. I got interested. You would see pictures of him. He's like this sort of, if you imagine a kind of Victorian gentleman with his long mutton chop whiskers, a large family, and a large girth around his tummy, a big, solid family fellow. Not the sort of man you'd imagine flying up in a balloon. But he was a wonderful Victorian scientist, and he'd learned his skills also out in Ireland. And he was fascinated by trying to get what he'd called data. We need data in order to understand what's going on in the upper air and the order in order to begin to forecast weather, to know about meteorological patterns. So he tries to get a series of assistants to go up in this big balloon, which is designed for high altitude. But they people don't go or they get ill. And finally, he goes out himself with a professional balloonist called Henry Coxwell. So it's James Glacier and Henry Coxwell. And in September 1862, they embark on this famous high-flying expedition. And this is roughly how it goes, that their balloon is designed for height. They have built in a laboratory in the basket, if you can imagine. There are wonderful engravings of this. Imagine a table built across the width of the basket and mounted on it is a massive instrumentation, chronometers, seven different types of barometer, temperature gauges, all kinds of equipment, binoculars, small baskets of pigeons, all kinds of equipment. And Glaisher is taking readings from all his equipment. This is one of the very moving things I found. They still exist, his journals, his observation journals. And I worked out that every minute, every 60 seconds, he was taking something like 12 or 15 accurate measurements from his different instruments, timing, barometer, temperature, and so on, noting them down. So you have this figure, there he is, this Victorian scientist, bent over his laboratory table as the balloon sails up under guidance of Henry Coxwell. So we know from his observation journal they go up, say, 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet, 20,000 feet, 25,000 feet. They've got very accurate Italian barometers, which are turned into altimeters, so they can measure their height very, very accurately based on the fall in air pressure. 25,000 feet is about Everest, I think, is 24-something thousand feet, which, of course, hadn't been climbed. And as everybody knows, you're approaching what modern climbers call the death zone, because the oxygen element, it becomes smaller and smaller, and it has various physiological effects, notably that all your muscular strength goes, your sight begins to go, and the amount of air that your lungs is taking in is reduced more and more. You pant, and you're not oxygenating your blood. Of course, they didn't know any of this. As I say, this is all unknown. So they were at 25,000 feet, still going up. Glaisher's measurements show that they were rising at 1,000 feet a minute. And Glaisher suddenly realized that he was having difficulty reading the instrumentation, the small, fine little markings on the barometers and so on, because his sight was going. So he reached across his table of this temporary laboratory desk, we think probably for his bottle of brandy, a wise move. And then he realized that his hand, he couldn't reach across and grip the brandy. His muscular strength was going. And then he realized, and there's an extraordinary description of this, he couldn't hold his head straight. It began to fall sideways on his left shoulder. And then he realized he couldn't hold himself upright, and he slumped back against the basket on the inside. They're still going up. They're now at 27, 28, 29,000 feet. He can just see that something's gone wrong in the basket, because his pilot, Henry Coxwell, is climbing into the hoop, that's the wooden hoop above the basket, from which the cables that hold the balloon are attached. And what's gone wrong is the hydrogen release valve, which is on a rope, usually in balloons, red, has got tangled up and is caught up in the hoop. So the only hope of stopping the descent is to pull that red hydrogen release rope, but it's up in the hoop. So Henry Coxwell, who is also beginning to suffer from this muscular failure and sight difficulties, climbs, can you imagine this, out of the basket, up into the hoop to get hold of the red release rope. When he gets there, he finds that he can't grip it with his hand because the muscular strength has gone. So he knocks it with his elbow, so it falls down back into the basket. This is the end of the rope. He fixes his elbows outwards so that they rest on each side of the hoop. He can't grip it, and lowers himself just back into the basket. He's failing. He can see his friend Glaisher is slumped backwards, probably dead. And he tries to grip the red release rope, but he can't. So what does he do? And as a little footnote, that his profession outside ballooning was a dentist. And he grips the rope with his teeth, and he pulls it, jerking his head up and down, and he makes the gas release, and the balloon begins to descend. And then this wonderful sequence, he's coming down, he's not sure if his friend Glaisher is still alive, so he crawls over across the basket to Mr. Glaisher, and he begins to shake him, and there's some signs that Glaisher is stirring as the oxygen gets back in his lung. And this is reported, the following dialogue took place. This is Henry Coxwell to James Glaisher, apparently near dead in the basket. He shakes him by the shoulders and he says, "Mr. Glaisher, Mr. Glaisher, do try and take some readings. Do try." And Glaisher stirs and sits upright and starts taking readings again. So the result is, we have a complete account of that flight, except for 13 minutes in which Glaisher was unconscious and Coxwell was up pulling the release valve. And we worked out from this amazing accurate observation journal, calculating on the height going up 1,000 feet every minute and then the time that it began to descend, it's pretty clear that the balloon went up certainly to 30,000 feet and possibly as high as 34,000 feet. So it might have climbed to 7 miles high. They come back down. The birds, incidentally, in the cage are dead. They land in the middle of the countryside near Ludlow. There's nobody there. It's completely deserted. They deflate the balloon. And these two Victorian scientists, who've just had this near-death experience, walk arm in arm across the fields for 7 miles, the exact distance they'd climbed in height, to the nearest pub, where they have a pint of beer together. Isn't that wonderful? And, of course, Glaisher publishes the papers. And what, crucially, it establishes for the first time that the thickness of the biosphere, the breathable air above us, is almost alarmingly thin. It's not much more than 7 miles max. So the distance they walk to the pub is the thickness of the entire atmosphere around the globe. And that is the first real concept of what we would now refer to as our fragile globe. The idea that the biosphere skin is so thin and can be easily damaged by any kind. That is produced by this great 1862 ascent. And it has these elements of comedy and heroic scientific endeavor with it all combined, and the Times of London writes the most wonderful leader about the courage of scientists and the importance of what they're doing, and it's one of the sort of striking moments in balloon history. And of course the whole history of meteorology then develops from that, pursued particularly by the Americans, Joseph Henry at Washington, and the French in Paris. They begin to develop ideas of cyclones and anticyclones, barometric pressure fronts moving, and the way weather can then be plotted on isobars and so on. All that comes out of this initial ballooning adventure. So once again, the rather eccentric history of ballooning opens up a very interesting area of general scientific history.
Richard, we are absolutely 100% out of time, and I have enjoyed completely this last hour. You tell a heck of a story, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Desiree. I've very enjoyed flying. Like many balloonists, I'm rather talkative. And another time, I will tell you my adventures at the Albuquerque International Hot Air Balloon Festival.
Oh, you are welcome back anytime. Thank you so much, Richard. That was wonderful. You can find a link to Richard Holmes and Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, you can find out how to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. Leave a comment on this or any other episode, and head over to iTunes to subscribe to the weekly podcast. See you next week.
Hello, Science for the People listeners. This is Rochelle Saunders. Before we sign off this week, we wanted to give a shout out to a group right here in our home base of Edmonton, Alberta, who we think are doing great work. This shout out goes to Deborah Kelly and the Strathcona Freethought Association, a small but dedicated group who meet monthly to discuss science and reason-based topics. And if you're interested in meeting up with them, you can check out their page on meetup.com, a link that will be available in our show notes at scienceforthepeople.ca. This group is also starting up a series of public discussions called the Critical Thinking Series, and everyone with an interest in science topics is welcome and encouraged to attend. Their first presentation is titled Science and Pseudoscience and is running on Thursday, March 27th at 7 p.m. at the Strathcona Community Center in Sherwood Park, Alberta. So if you're in the Edmonton area and love science as much as we do, please do look these folks up. And as always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Science for the People.